Chibundu Onozo is a Nigerian author from one of the world's largest and most vibrant cities, and it's the subject of her first novel, Welcome to Lagos. Plus, Chicago writer Abby Jeanne has always been in love with the outdoors, but her second novel, The Wildlands, is about nature's darker side and one Oklahoma family's struggle to survive.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up on this special encore edition of The 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All this week, we're sharing some of our favorite conversations with writers. Later this hour, we'll hear from Chicago author Abby Jeanne about her second novel, The Wildlands. But first, Lagos, Nigeria is one of the biggest and fastest growing cities in Africa, if not the world. Like any big metropolitan city, you meet people from all walks of life trying to make it in their own way. For Nigerian writer Chibundu Onozo, Lagos is also the city of, quote, my birth, my dreams, my frustration, my imagination. And it's the site of her latest novel called Welcome to Lagos. I spoke with her last summer when it was first being released in the U.S. So this is your second novel. Mm-hmm. Your first, The Spider King's Daughter, you started writing when you were 17?
Yes, that is correct.
So I always wonder with writers how hard it is if you put a lot of pressure on yourself after, especially for a second novel.
So Welcome to Lagos took longer to write. But finishing The Spider King's Daughter was so liberating because I'd been writing novels since I was 10. And I feel like from the age of 10, I took it seriously. Like at 10, I was like, I'm going to write the great Nigerian novel.
Wow.
Okay, well, maybe not that seriously. But I did, you know, take it seriously. But all these projects that I started from 10, I never finished them. So when I was 17 and I finally finished something, it was like a massive breakthrough. So with Welcome to Lagos, even though it took longer, just having done it once before gave me space.
And so there's a line that's I believe it's the last line of the acknowledgements where you say that Lagos is the city of my birth, my dreams, my frustration, my imagination. Mm-hmm. Did you set out to write this novel about Lagos from the beginning?
No, I didn't actually. So the novel starts with two soldiers who disobey an order and then they desert the army. And in my initial draft, I didn't decide that they would run away to Lagos. I knew I wanted them to run away to a big city to hide. But I didn't decide on the Nigerian city till about maybe 50 pages in. And then I thought, okay, Lagos is going to be the city. So the novel certainly grew to fill the title.
And did I read that your two main characters, your initial characters, I should say, did that come from a dream you had?
Yes, it did. It sounds so cliche. And like, it's just, I feel like even when I say it, it just sounds like a lie. But it's true. I actually had it. And I don't feel like a spooky, mystical person. And I don't often write down my dreams. But yes, I did have a very vivid dream about two soldiers who disobey an order. And they're Nigerian soldiers. And you know, dream logic is a bit weird. So they're also in a medieval castle, which didn't quite make it into the novel.
Did not make it into the novel.
It didn't make it into the novel. But yeah, so then I then transplanted that to a real conflict in Nigeria. And then the story went on from there.
And there is actually a basis of historical fact of this fictional novel. Can you tell us about that?
So in the, you know, I really should know the exact year now. Because
is it around 1991?
Yeah. No, 1998, around 1998, 1999, there's a town called Odi, where a similar thing happened, like what I described in the novel. Soldiers were killed, and militants were blamed, and the militants were hiding in a village, and militants were freedom fighters, depending on whose perspective, obviously. And the army went in, and when the town didn't deliver up these people who had allegedly killed the soldiers, they actually leveled the town, Odi in Bayelsa State. So yes, what I describe in the book is based on a real event that happened. And then I was sort of imagining, well, what would happen if somebody had said no? And it doesn't matter what army you're in, no matter if you feel that the command is unjust, you know, you can look at this in conflicts all around the world, conflicts that America has been involved in, whatever the country, you know, soldiers sometimes have to carry out orders that they may personally believe are morally questionable. But then what happens when somebody says no? And often, even though you might agree that it's right to say no, you have to flee, you have to run away because the consequences of disobeying are very high.
And so you have these two gentlemen, but then it very quickly grows into this sort of motley crew of a cast of characters. How did you decide to originally start with, I guess it's the original five people and then the group grows?
Well, I guess that's part of sort of the magic of writing a novel. So like, you know, characters and different stories just kept popping into my head. So it was natural that the first person they meet would be one of the enemy because they're still in the field when they desert. So they meet a militant, a freedom fighter, and then another character came. And actually, so I ended up with five in the novel, but I actually at a point had about 20. And it was just chaos. It was absolute chaos. It was so difficult to keep track of all the stories. So I actually had to bump off a few characters. You know, it was very intense. I lined them up against the wall. And I said, justify your place in the book. And if you couldn't justify your place in the book, you got killed, summarily beheaded.
So who was the most painful to cut? Now I don't want to...
I don't like talking about earlier
the characters
drafts
that didn't make it.
Yeah, because the only version of the book that exists for the reader is the one that they hold in their hands. But I will mention, this is the one I've agreed that I will share. There was a baby. And it's a sort of literary trope slash cliche to have a group cement and solidify around a baby. In movie form, it happens in three men and a little baby. So yeah, I mean,
you didn't want to do the Nigerian version of that.
But the problem with the baby is I just kept forgetting the baby. And the problem with babies is that they're incredibly high maintenance. You can't just have them off stage for like 10 chapters.
And they can't be running through all the different scenes as they're running all over the city.
Exactly. Somebody has to be feeding the baby.
Living under a bridge.
Exactly. So the baby was just too high maintenance. So I'm sadly, the baby had to go.
My guest is Chibundo Onuzo. Her most recent book is called Welcome to Lagos. And you grew up there. Mm-hmm. And then you moved to England when you were 14?
Yes.
Was this always a city that you wanted to write about in so much detail? Because no. I think that's the other character in the book, right? Mm. Obviously, is the city.
No, it wasn't actually. So when I actually lived in Lagos, I didn't set any of my fiction in Nigeria. And I call it self-provincialization. And sometimes you can see it in children who grew up in capitals around the world, but are consuming a lot of American or European media. So you just start feeling that the world is happening somewhere else.
Only in New York or London.
Exactly. You know, I was saying when I went to New York, I mean, I've been before, but you know, when I went on this trip, you know, I was joking with someone who was with me that I need to walk into the street and have a cab almost run me over and then say, I'm walking here. These images have been so disseminated all over the world. So you come to a place where you're not familiar with, but you are familiar with because you've been watching it so much. And it was the same with me. So writing in Lagos, I lived in a city with 15 million people and counting, you know, but I felt the world was happening somewhere else. So I set my fiction actually in America when I lived in Nigeria. And it was only after I moved to England, I realized that I'd come from a very interesting and complex and just complicated and very just vibrant place. And then I started setting my fiction in Nigeria.
And I do think there is something to that, though, right? When we think about all of the, there is such discussion about the Nigerian novelist and all of that now. But I also, it's a really interesting idea of expanding the idea of place, because I think so much of our literary world is very concentrated on big white cities.
Well, I mean, obviously, like, so much of our literary world where, like, you know, the literary world in Nigeria, there's a vibrant, you know, publishing industry going on in Nigeria. And this is what I'm saying about, you know, there's no center to the world. I wasn't saying the world is round. So even when, you know, you say, you know, who is which you know, for people in Lagos, you know, their literary world does not include, I mean, I'm not saying that people don't read books set in New York or in England, in Nigeria. But what I'm saying is that there's also a vibrant, you know, local publishing scene that perhaps people in America haven't heard about. And I feel like increasingly, in a more global world, you're at a disadvantage if you're not interested in what's going on outside your borders, because everybody else knows about you, but you don't know about anybody else. So you kind of have that actually information asymmetry.
That said, did you write this book specifically for an audience, whether that was inside Nigeria or out?
No, I feel when you're writing a book, the truth is there's only one audience. You are your audience. It's an audience of one. And I often tell people, with Welcome to Lagos, part of the reason why it took so long was because it was very difficult for me to get the third person narrative voice I wanted right. And I remembered I would show it to people and they'll say, oh, you know, I'm enjoying it. Yeah, this is enjoyable. But it wasn't right to me. You know, I'm a musician. So I know about you watch people when they tune. It's like everybody has their internal tuning fork. And you, somebody else might be like, no, this is fine. It's like, no. It's not on pitch to me, okay? My tuning fork is saying this is out of tune. So with Welcome to Lagos, I was my audience. It was what I wanted first before you think about a wider readership.
And to that point of tuning, I wanted to ask you about language in the book, because there are so many different languages. There's so many different versions of English. And you even talk about even that, also a theme of the book, the different classes in which how people communicate to each other. Was that an important part of the book for you, or did that just sort of come out?
I think it's just true to how Lagos is in real life. Lagos is a magnet. It's an economic magnet, not just for other Nigerians. It's across West Africa and across Africa. So many people are drawn to the city. It's very cosmopolitan. And I mean, sometimes in African cities as well, not to say that there's not a European population, but you know, if you look out on the city, you might see that everybody's black and therefore then assume that, you know, this is a homogenous place. But that's very far from the case. You know, that's how it is in Lagos. You go through some places, people are speaking Yoruba, some people are speaking Pidgin in the same bus, people are speaking Igbo, people are speaking Hausa. These are Nigerian languages. People are speaking Nigerian English. You know, the radio presenters on the radio are speaking often in an American accent because that shows to some people a certain level of sophistication.
There's just so much. It's like Fine Boys. So you just did exactly. You were just doing one of the characters for the
book,
right?
Exactly. Yes, I have an aspiring radio presenter in the book, and he feels like, you know, to make it, he has to sound
American.
Exactly.
Oh, it's so interesting. So you mentioned the bus. One of my favorite scenes is in the beginning of the book, just four of them at that point, when they get on the bus, and how everyone starts praying, and they don't want the bus to go until the whole bus is taken part in this prayer. Mm-hmm. And I was so charmed by this scene, but I wanted to ask, does that happen?
It does. It does.
Can you describe this scene for people who haven't read the book?
Okay, so basically they're about to set off on probably about 8-hour bus ride. They're going by night as well. There's a phrase in Nigeria where people pray, we don't want to go out on a day where the road is hungry. Because there's an idea, like a metaphorical idea, that the road drinks blood. Because, you know, when there's an accident, blood will be spilled on the road. So they are praying that the journey is going to be fine. But then it's almost kind of like Jonah and the whale. You don't want anybody to attract any ill omen or ill or ill luck to the group. So, you know, when they pray, everybody has to say amen. Like, if you're not saying amen, maybe you're
the one that's going to cause the accident.
Exactly.
Okay. But though, there is a role of faith in this book, in this story, where it's not just a political tool, but there's also, it's a genuine moral center for many of the characters. But I wonder what you were hoping people who weren't religious maybe might take away from the portrayal of the different religion or faith that's in this book.
I mean, I wasn't thinking about people who were religious or not religious when I was writing this. I was thinking about myself. And one thing Toni Morrison says, you know, if you feel there's a story that hasn't been written, you know, write it yourself. And this is not to say that, you know, faith hasn't been explored in fiction before, but I just feel it's not been done often enough in a way that I've enjoyed and liked. So an example of someone who I love and whose work I admire is Marilynne Robinson. And she showed me in her fiction that you can explore faith in a way, even if you're a Christian yourself, that is not proselytizing. And I'm not saying that there's not a place for that. I love C.S. Lewis. I love his apologetic work. But that's not what I wanted to achieve in a novel. And my main character, Chike, in fact, I would describe him as an agnostic, a seeker. And so what he does is, they never go to church. They never see a pastor.
But it's a very religious family. This kind of family that has come together. They have this evening ritual where Chike is reading the Bible to everyone. And they're all, it's a very reverent, it seems like a very reverent moment they all have together every evening.
And I feel like that goes back to a more elemental version of church. Because, you know, in places where for example, the church is persecuted and there are no superstructures, there's no cathedral or no place where a bishop can stand up, the church still goes on because church is not building, it's people. It's individuals coming together and going on that journey of faith.
My guest is Chibundu Onozu. She's the author of Welcome to Lagos. As we're talking about this, there's also, I think, a really interesting part of the book that I think is very matter of fact, which is that there's Muslims and Christians mm-hmm. who are living alongside each other mm-hmm. with no, it's just sort of a very matter of fact interaction mm-hmm. that they have on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Was that deliberate on your part?
You see, the thing is, that type of interaction never makes the news. Okay, so sometimes I'll go for these interviews and they'll say, Muslims and Christians in Nigeria are at war. And I'm like, you need to qualify that statement. You know, where are they at war? Definitely not in my family. So my mom used to be a Muslim, actually. She's from a Muslim family. Her father was an Alaji, which means, you know, he went on pilgrimage to Mecca. He was polygamous. He married four wives. I must add, not all at the same time. He only ever had two at once. So he wasn't a greedy man. And she converted to Christianity. She still has relatives who are Muslims. She married somebody from another ethnic group, which is my father. And it's not just, you know, tolerance. It's not actually people tolerating each other. It's like people enjoying each other's company and actually living.
Yeah, it's just life.
Yes, exactly. But that doesn't make the news. You know, what makes the news is when it erupts, when there are eruptions of violence and conflict, et cetera, et cetera.
That's Chibundu Onozu, author of the novel Welcome to Lagos. I spoke with her from the studios of Northwestern University in Evanston last summer. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll finish that conversation on the other side of this short break. Welcome back to a special edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just tuning in, all this week we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations we've had with writers. Today, we're hearing from Chibundu Onozu, author of the novel Welcome to Lagos. I spoke with her last summer when she was in Chicago, just as the book was being released in the U.S. Let's hear the rest of that conversation. So we've talked about faith and sort of just how that's a very normal thing. There's also, I think, which also seems like very normal, is the level of corruption. That's another, I think, theme of the book.
Yes. I mean, you know, see, Nigerians, you know, when we go abroad, we get very defensive.
I know. I was wondering I was curious about if that was something you thought about when you were writing as a portrayal of Nigeria too.
Yes, I mean, I wrote it because I was interested in it and I was interested in exploring the fact that, you know, corruption is not this massive superstructure run by some bogeyman.
It's kind of funny. It's a very absurdist way this sort of the whole thing plays out also, I think.
It's human beings, you know, like sometimes we make, you know, corruption seem like this thing over there that, you know, is some supernatural force. It's people. It's somebody's dad. It's somebody's mom. It's somebody's auntie and uncle. I mean, obviously, before, I feel like as a Nigerian, a proud Nigerian, I must add, you know, corruption is not a Nigerian problem, okay? It's a global problem. There's corruption everywhere.
You're in Illinois. This is one of the most, we have the notorious distinction of having the most governors who have ended up in prison.
Exactly. So you know where I'm coming from. I feel like it's not, and also, like, you know, but the Nigerian, you know, corruption is a global system. You know, this money that they're hiding, where does it go to? You know, it comes to European capitals, it comes to American capitals, it bolsters foreign property markets, but nobody wants to have that.
Right, there's a great scene where you talk about that in London, the apartment.
Yes, exactly.
The North Kensington apartment, and it made me think of that, how many places in London are basically havens for people who are storing their money.
But it's just like, oh, these Africans, why are they always stealing? It's like, why are you always colluding with us, okay? But anyway, so yes, I mean, I did want to explore the theme of corruption, but also from a, like, an individual perspective, like what it means. Because even though the system is corrupt, human beings still have agency. Even though it's more difficult to be honest, there is still that choice and people still, you know, choose the wrong thing. So I wanted to write a little bit about individual agency.
The journalist in me was really pleased at the way journalism was portrayed in this book. I have to say, I have a normal pet peeve. I hate normally when journalists are always, I always think it's completely unrealistic the way that the story is portrayed. But that's also another really important theme of the book. One of the characters is a newspaper owner who decides to take on all of this corruption and the government, a Nigerian.
Yes, I mean, that was a very enjoyable part. I mean, some people have read it and felt that, you know, I'm being cynical and saying that, you know, if people are crusading against corruption, it's always going to end badly. And I think that's not what I'm trying to say. What I was trying to say with that character was that it's important to have these stories being told. And you can't give up if it fails the first time. And I mean, I'm not going to, you know, spoil the plot, but there's a bit of a Phoenix bit where do you continue with this journalism, with this crusading when it all goes wrong?
When you see the cost of it.
Yes, when you see the cost of it. That's what and I mean, people have, especially journalists in Nigeria, they have paid a very high price for press freedom, for the right to challenge, you know, the government. But out of their ashes, others have risen again. And I mean, his newspaper was actually based, again, on a real-life newspaper called 234 Next. And it was founded by a man called Dele Olojede, who is not my character. But he moved from America to Nigeria to found this sort of newspaper that was crusading against the government, crusading against corruption. And it didn't work. It didn't work financially. The quality of journalism was great, but they couldn't make it be profitable.
That's not a problem just in Nigeria. But
I guess what I wanted to, I mean, even if that didn't work, does that mean we're going to end crusading against corruption? Like, you have to find another. I've moved from being a cynic about Nigeria to being an optimistic realist, which is that things are difficult and that your first attempt at change might fail the first time. But we can't stop at the first attempt. I say this sitting from America, but like, just as a Nigerian, I feel like we can't stop at the first attempt.
My guest is Chibundi Onozu. She's the author of Welcome to Lagos. And I think that's a really interesting attitude for someone to have. I think oftentimes when you are born somewhere and you move, part of the immigrant experience is a romanticization of where you were, you know, and I think it's probably more true for older people when they've had spent their formative years somewhere else and then have moved away. And, you know, I'm thinking of my parents moving to the U.S. when they were in their 20s and 30s, as opposed to you were 14. I wonder how this book changed your relationship of how you thought about Lagos.
So obviously, Lagos is a city that does not take romanticization very well. So even if you, I mean, I go
which
back to
you
Lagos,
do, and you don't, the book does not romanticize
exactly.
it at all.
I go back to Lagos at least once a year. Even if you arrive with rose-tinted glasses, after 20 minutes in the airport, your glasses will very quickly darken. They will very quickly turn into sunshades, regular sunshades. So, no, it's not a city, but it's still a city that I love. I always say Lagos is like Red Bull. It gives you wings, you know, you arrive and everybody's alive. Everything is in Technicolor. So I don't think I romanticize it, but I think going away allowed me to appreciate what was so unique about Lagos. And I just feel there's nowhere like it in the world. I mean, I haven't traveled everywhere in the world, but I've been to a couple of capitals. I've been to Seoul. I've been to Johannesburg. I've been to Rio. These are all great, fantastic places. And often as a writer, you're traveling as a writer, which also is a bit of a privileged way to travel as well. But, you know, just like every proud Nigerian, there's no place like home. You know, Niger is the best.
And do you think partially this is a way of also connecting with what you lost when you left?
That's a really good question, actually. I think yes, it's good to leave home and come back, because there are things that are better elsewhere. So, like, you know, we can't, so infrastructurally, you know, roads, electricity, stuff like that. So yes, you know, there are things that are better elsewhere, but there are also things that we do in Nigeria really well. There's a national character, there's a resilience, there's a
confidence. You haven't even talked about the food.
There's the food, of course. But there's a confidence with which Nigerians move through the world. And it doesn't matter, even if we go somewhere and you don't want us. The way Nigeria has raised us and schooled us and emboldened us means that we move through the world differently. You need to leave Nigeria to appreciate that. You know, you need to, like, you know, you can go to other places. Like, we're not easily cowed, you know. A Nigerian will be the first person to say, if they see someone jumping the queue, you better get behind, you know. If you walk over other people, you cannot walk over us. Sometimes you have to leave to appreciate what's so great. Because sometimes when you're there, you know, and it's not that there are not things to moan about, corruption, electricity, you know, crime, poverty, there are things to moan about. But I think sometimes when you leave, that's when you realize there's actually a lot to celebrate. And I'm glad I'm in Nigeria.
So that said, you're getting your PhD now at King's College in London, is that right?
Yes, I am.
So would you go, are you planning to go back to Nigeria one day?
Well, I mean, that's the hope. The truth is, the longer you stay away, the more difficult it is to resettle. So obviously, visiting Nigeria, I have my parents live in Nigeria. My brother lives in Nigeria. So there's no way I'll ever be, you know, cut off completely. But it's true that, you know, the longer you stay away, you know, as the Bible says, you know, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. You know, the flesh likes constant electricity. The flesh likes, I don't know, Chick-fil-A. So, but no, I love home. And I mean, I don't like to stay away from Nigeria for too long. And I still, it's home. Nigeria is home.
You could read much more about this home in Welcome to Lagos. Chibundu Onozu is the author of Welcome to Lagos. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Chicago writer Abby Jeanney has been writing novels since she was a little kid. She's also always been in love with the outdoors. So perhaps it's fitting her second novel is called The Wildlands. It's a story about not just nature, but survival, family, and making it on your own. I spoke with Abby last fall, and I started by asking her if she's always been someone who reads and writes about animals.
In a word, yes. I've become one of those people where people are like, you write about animals. Here's a book about animals. So I have a huge library of nonfiction books that I read constantly about animals, about the natural world. I love documentaries. I'm just constantly absorbing.
And in this case, this novel starts with this pretty amazing scene of, and it's this description of a tornado hitting a home in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any personal experience with this?
Well, my husband's family, my wonderful in-laws, are Oklahomans. They actually live, their kids went to school in Moore, where that huge tornado hit a couple years ago. So, like, school was canceled because there was no more school because the building was gone. And an inspiration for this also, we had some really dear friends when I was a kid growing up, and they had this happen where their entire house, they were in the basement, and the entire house was taken away by the storm. And they heard the rain right above them. And it took them a minute to realize that you shouldn't be able to hear rain if you're in the basement. And when they came up, it was just a swath of destruction strewn across the landscape. So it hasn't happened to me, but it's happened sort of to my nearest and dearest.
And it sounds like you also, based on the description, did a lot of research into what it looks like when a tornado happens, because it's really vivid, that prologue of the minutes before the tornado touches down and hits the farm.
Well, thank you. Yes, I did a ton of research. And I confess I loved Twister and I love all of those disaster movies. I will also say this may not be interesting to anyone but me, but I often dream about tornadoes, and I have these incredibly vivid, terrifying dreams about them. So I feel like I've seen them often in my non-waking life.
Oh, that's terrible. When did those start?
They are correlated with migraines, which I get. Whenever I'm in a lot of physical pain, I dream about tornadoes.
Wow. And so did any of your dreams of tornadoes end up in this description?
Oh, yeah. The watching the, you know, the cloud take shape and watching the sky turn green and, you know, the birds flying backwards and upside down. All those things are things I've experienced in my terrible, terrible nightmares.
Oh, no. Well, I'm sorry about that. But it's great reading, I will say. So the Wildlands, main character is this little girl named Cora. Mm-hmm. Where did she come from?
She came from me. All my characters. I feel like writing is partly a process of creation and partly a process of discovery. So I always sort of feel like they're probably out there somewhere already existing, and my job is to kind of half make them, but also to kind of find them as they are. I will say I was a very tomboyish, tree-climbing, animal-obsessed little kid, and, you know, there's a lot of me in Cora.
That's what I was going to ask. And I also read that you started writing at a really early age.
I did. I started writing when I was about 6. So basically, as soon as I was able to write, I was writing. And I was started writing like with the force of a freight train. Like I was writing novels by the time I was, you know, 8 or 9. I wrote for hours every day after school. And I thought this was completely normal. I was like, this is what one does. One goes home after school and one writes, you know, a novel. And it was not till I was in middle school, I was riding the bus home with a friend of mine. And she said, what are you doing after school today? And I said, well, I'm going to go home and write. And she said, write what? And I was like, oh, this is unusual. Like, it took me that long to figure it out. So I think there's some of that in Cora as well, because she kind of slips into this, you know, as the story progresses and she falls under her brother's influence more and more, she kind of disappears into this not quite reality. And I think that was a place I kind of lived in sometimes when I was creating stories as a kid.
Do you have siblings?
I have a younger brother.
And so there's a really interesting dynamic, because this story is about this family of 4 children and young people who are, I'm not going to give anything away, because if you read the first chapter, you know that they are orphaned. And yes. So it's basically the story of how the 18-year-old sister really is trying to raise all of the other kids. Mm-hmm. And that's a really interesting dynamic. I have to say, when I was reading it in the beginning, I was kind of confused, because I thought it was something that was like set a long time ago. Because it sort of seemed like they were just on their own and really in this sort of isolated way. I wonder, where did you get the idea that kind of creating them off by themselves, and that it was really these 4 kids who are really struggling to figure everything out, and they don't really have any help?
That's true. I would say in an early draft of the book, there was a mother in it. And I thought it would be interesting to write a mother character who's kind of a non-entity. Like, she's there. She's not really helping. Darlene is in charge of everything. Darlene being the oldest sister. And my editor was actually the one who said, you know, it's more interesting if they're orphans and they have no support system whatsoever. So I think I may have leaned into that a little bit. But I also, there's that, I don't know, it's like a fantasy / nightmare of childhood where you're off on your own. Like the Boxcar Children, and, you know, a lot of those stories of, you know, kids kind of growing up in this feral, wild state. And so there's some of that where it's kind of a wonderful dream that you have as a kid. And it's also sort of a terrible thing that if it happens in real life, it's a nightmare.
Right. And there's this line in the book when Cora realizes how different she is, how other kids have families, they have parents to go home to. And she doesn't really even remember her parents, because she's the youngest one. And so she doesn't remember them at all.
Yeah, that was something that I was interested in, too. Like, Cora, her waking life kind of begins with the storm. So, you know, the other siblings, they remember their parents. They remember having a home. They remember having a father who took care of them. Cora, you know, her life began sort of when the tornado blew through town and took everything away. So I was interested in what that would be like for that kind of that child who's off on their own to not have a memory of a life before that.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this encore conversation with Chicago writer Abby Jeanie. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Abby Genie. She's a Chicago writer and author of the novel The Wildlands. I spoke with her last fall, just ahead of the book's release. The Wildlands is set in rural Oklahoma, and in part, it's a story about a young girl named Cora who becomes orphaned after a tornado hits her family home. Though the setting is a far cry from Abby's own upbringing here in Illinois, she knows about Oklahoma through her in-laws. So I asked her if she could explain a little bit more about why that was the right place to set her novel.
I was really struck by the place when I was there. Whenever I would visit, I would think, this is a whole other world. I remember, you know, we'd come in the summer and all of this grass would just be like this weird, eerie yellow because it, you cannot water it enough for it to survive in that sunlight. So
really different from where you grew up in Evanston in by Lake Michigan,
yes,
right?
Yes, I grew up in a little garden, you know, and then I would go to this sort of like desert place where they were scorpions that you had to, you know, like they, my husband would tell me stories about, you know, you'd see the scorpion on the ceiling and you'd hit, try to hit it with a shoe. And I was like, yeah, there are no scorpions where I grew up. That seems like, I don't know, a strange place. But yeah, I did a lot of research. I do a lot of research about everything I write. And I loved reading about the animals of that place and also reading about what's happening to the small towns, because I think that they are struggling. They are dying. They are in a place that is not really a sustainable place for humans to live. And that's part of what's happening to them.
I also think the really interesting part of this is the interplay with animals. And I think there's kind of this tendency that often people would think they would have to anthropomorphize them. But you actually don't really, like, the animals are animals. Like, there's no human traits here. And in fact, if anything, the humans are more like animals, I feel like, in this. Was that I imagine, a deliberate choice on your part. You're nodding.
Yes, that is a very deliberate choice on my part. I think the tendency to anthropomorphize is really harmful for both humans and for animals, so the way we interact with them. And I think that we are animals. You know, we are of the primate family. You know, we are connected to apes and we are connected to monkeys and we are connected to everything. And we think of ourselves as being so separate. And that's bad for us. It's bad for us in so many different ways. It's bad for our world. It's bad for the way we treat our world. I think it's bad for our spirits and our souls. And so when I thought about writing this, the last thing I want is to write animals that are like people. I want to illustrate the fact that we are actually like them because we are them, because, you know, we're an unusual kind of animal, but we are part of the animal kingdom. This planet is our planet. You know, these animals, their instincts and their nature can tell us something about our own. Hmm. Rather than the other way around, I guess.
Right. And I wonder, as you're saying that, I feel like I'm hearing a little bit of Cora's big brother in your voice here. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about Cora's brother.
Well, Tucker is sort of the human tornado in the story. He's an eco-terrorist and he, you know, disappears from the family for a while and then comes back with a vengeance and, you know, sets off a bomb and basically kidnaps Cora, and that kicks off the plot as the two of them on this eco-terrorist spree across the Southwest. And I was interested in writing a character who is right in his motivations but wrong in his actions, because a lot of times I agree with Tucker. Like, I know he is someone who knows all the things that I know and has taken it in a very different direction from myself. I love to write about these things, to talk about these things, to participate in, you know, peaceful activism.
Right, you're not blowing up. No. You're not trying to blow up beauty supply or
right.
release animals from different places. Like, in this case, the makeup facility
right.
where perhaps they're testing with animals.
Yes, which is why he blows up the factory. But I also feel like I understand how he got into that state. You know, I understand the urgency that drives him. And I understand that once you know a certain amount about this, you can't forget it. You can't put it away in a box and live your life as though it's not happening. My favorite villains are the ones where you're like, well, they kind of have a point, you know, where you're along for the ride for a while and then eventually they begin to go too far. And Cora falls under his sway, and I kind of wanted the reader to fall under his sway too.
I was also really interested in the thread of this book of trauma and tragedy and how people deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that part of, you could say very clearly, what changes Tucker is the tornado and losing his parents. And that kind of sets him on this path of eco-terrorism.
Yeah.
And there is, I think, kind of this unspoken conversation throughout the whole book about his mental state and his mental health.
Mm-hmm.
How did you deal with that? How did you think about that part of what motivated him?
About what his mental health would
yes.
be. That's an interesting question.
Because he seems kind of a little manic and not making the most rational choices. Even the way you described how he talks and he kind of just goes into these sort of these states.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I shied away from diagnosing him in the book. I think it's, you know, I'm sure you've seen this on online communities. Someone will say, I'm having this issue with my relative. And everyone will say, that person has narcissistic personality disorder. And you'll think, well, you read three sentences.
Using the web to diagnose medical issues is always an interesting thing.
Yeah. So I think, and I also think that there's a tendency to pathologize certain behavior, I think especially behavior on the part of white men, to say, well, that's not really his fault because of this condition, which is something we have to have sympathy for. And I was wary of doing that in this case. I think that most people of that age are kind of unstable. Like, have you ever met a teenager? Like, what
or
are
a
they
20
doing?
Year old, right? Right? Yeah. Because he's like 20, which is not the most stable age.
Yeah.
Sure.
So I feel like he's
apologies to all the 20 year olds who are listening right now. But yes.
I was 20 once. I was a lunatic at that age. But I thought I knew everything. Because that's the thing about that age is that you feel everything so passionately. You're having such big shifts in your personality. If you undergo trauma at that age, I think that just enhances the process. Mm-hmm. And nobody can tell you anything because you know best. And you're the first person to ever have these experiences in the history of the world. So I think it was in my mind that it would if Tucker lived in a different place and had a different kind of support system, he would probably be diagnosed with something. He would probably be, you know, seeing a therapist.
I also was really interested in the way that when tragedy strikes, how other people deal with that, which is not very well, and how the rest of the town doesn't really help them. Granted, everyone's got a lot of problems. You make that pretty clear. Mm-hmm. This is a small town where a lot of people are really struggling economically in lots of other ways. But it was an interesting commentary to me about how oftentimes as humans, we're pretty ill-equipped to help each other.
Yeah, I my grandfather just passed away. I was thinking about that because people will say, call me if you need anything.
Yeah. They don't know what to say.
Right. But it's also like, I'm never going to call you. Like, I'm never going to call you and say, I need something. It's, you know, we don't know how to help each other. We don't know what the other person needs. And I also think that there's that kind of magical thinking of this terrible thing has happened. Let's find a reason for it to happen so that it won't happen to me. And that person over there that it happened to is tainted in some way or is bad in some way, brought this on themselves in some way. I am not like that. I will not go near them and get that contagion on me. And we kind of create this narrative which allows us to have less empathy than maybe we should have.
You teach as well. Mm-hmm. How does that affect your writing?
I love teaching. I teach at Story Studio Chicago, which is this wonderful writing studio for grown-ups, not for kids. and writing is such a solitary thing. You know, so you're alone in a room and you're having this intuitive, instinctive process that you're creating in silence. And then you go into a place where people say, okay, tell me how to do this process. And you have to think, I know how to do that, but I don't know how to say it in words. I'm going to think about how to say it in words, and then I'm going to understand it better. And then even in my own process, alone in the room in silence again, I'm going to understand better how to do it. So I love teaching writing, A, because it's, you know, talking to other people as opposed to writing alone in my room, which sometimes is good. And also just because it really does help me understand my own work better.
I was trying to describe the Wildlands to some people, and I was thinking one of the things that kind of just came out was, I feel like this is sort of like a Midwest, Oklahoma, Midwest magical realism, if there was such a thing. I don't know if that exists.
There should be such a thing.
I wonder what writers you really get inspiration from.
Oh, I love that question, but I always struggle with that question because I am one of the rare breed of novelists who can't read other novels because it bleeds into my own writing.
Oh, interesting. So you don't read novels. You don't read fiction.
I love fiction so much. I read it so much as a kid.
And now you don't read any fiction.
I don't. So it's like this terrible loss of like all these books, which I'm like, one day maybe. So what I read is nonfiction because that is what feeds my writing. But I will say, in terms of writers who I think are interested in the balance of science and nature and, you know, character development and all that, I think, you know, Barbara Kingsolver was a big influence on me. Margaret Atwood in her own way, although hers tends, I think, toward the more magical and mine not so much. But most of what I read is nonfiction. I'm so sorry, fiction writers. I am one of you.
I was going to say, you're one of them. That said, then, so what's really interesting to me that you say that, because I imagine you read a lot of scientific, maybe not articles, but research. And I wonder what you think about the state of how we treat science. Like, do you think that we treat it like fiction nowadays?
Well, it depends who you mean by we. And, you know, this is a nation which has always had sort of two different populations under one roof, and we don't always get along. And right now we get along even less. But yes, I feel like there is a vast swath of society which is just not interested in science and sees it as, you know, what alternative facts or whatever the, you know, the jargon is. They don't see it as different than a myth or a story. And they're interested in their own myths or stories. And it just breaks my heart because I feel like there's nothing more beautiful or more true or more magical than science.
And I think that's interesting because I think this is actually something that cuts across political lines, because you have, whether you're talking about, it's not necessarily a conservative or a progressive or a Democrat or Republican thing, if you're thinking about vaccines or climate change or genetically modified crops. I think that oftentimes when I talk to scientists, they feel really attacked by both the right and the left right now.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah. I think of science particularly in terms of, you know, evolution, nature. So I was thinking more of sort of the
climate change and those sorts of things.
But no, you're absolutely right. I think my sense is that I was reading an article about this, and unfortunately I can't remember the name of it. But it was talking about how the whole human race changed when we saw our planet from outer space. And we realized that we are really this tiny speck in the universe. And I think there's a big part of the population that is just like, nope, I am not engaging with that. That is too big of an idea. It is too scary. I want to have just my beliefs and my stories, and I don't want to engage with that. And I think there's another part of the population that's like, this is fascinating. Let's learn more. And that's me.
That said, has your relationship to nature changed since you started writing both your first novel and this? Is so much about the natural world is so fundamental to these stories?
Yes, I think that there's a way, you know, I grew up in an urban environment, and so nature is like, isn't it beautiful? Look at it there. It's like a beautiful painting. And there's a way that you see it as this kind of lovely other. And the more I have learned about science, A, the more I see it as individual things, like this particular tree, this species of bird, this, you know, how fungus interacts with different kinds of plant life. But I also see how I am not apart from it, and it is not apart from me, and how I used to imagine, like, here's the urban over here, there's the wild over there, they should never connect to each other. But, you know, like, we have animals that live in our houses. And
we have coyotes.
Yes, we do. We have.
And as we're saying this, there's a weird bug that's crawling on the wall.
Yes, right, I noticed this. That too. It's an ant. Yeah, we have ants and spiders and rats and raccoons and skunks and, you know, house sparrows and plants. And, I mean, you know, our lives are filled with nature, but we have this imagined world in which that's not the case, in which it's something outside.
Do you have kids?
I do.
What do you want them to know about nature?
Everything. I have a 5-year-old son, and he learned really early on that if he ever wants mommy's full attention, all he has to do is ask me a question about nature or make an observation. So if it's like, mommy, play trucks with me, I'm like, well, I have a million things to do. But if he's like, mommy, why are there shadows? I'm like, let's just stop everything and discuss this for as long as we need to discuss this. So yeah, so I'm accidentally training him to be just like me.
So I read an interview from a few years back that this book was originally going to be titled Zoomania. Why did you decide on the Wildlands instead?
Oh, Zoomania, my heart. So it's actually pronounced Zoomania, which nobody can say. So we officially decided we were going to call it Zoomania because that's what people can say. Zoomania is a word that means an obsession with animals.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But Zoomania, of course, kind of, you can imagine how to spell and picture that word, and it also carries, I think, the same connotation of just like animals mania, wah. And I loved Zoomania. It was, you know, it was the perfect title for me. And you know, we were talking about the diagnosis of Tucker and the possibility of diagnosing a character. I would say that's what he's got, is, you know,
Zoomania.
Yeah, he suffers from Zoomania.
That sounds about accurate.
But then as we were getting closer and closer to the book, the movie Zootopia came out. And even my husband kept saying, so how's Zootopia going? And I'd be like, do you mean Zoomania, my novel, as opposed to Zootopia, the movie that our child is watching? And we realized it was too close and people would get it mixed up. But I have hope. I talked to my, it's going to be published in French, and I talked to my French editor, and she says that would be a great title in France. So it may yet happen.
Okay, great. I like The Wildlands. The Wildlands is out. Abby, thanks again for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for us today. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.